When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design, thoughtful construction, and little details that make life in your space easier. And now they're bringing that comfort and style outside with their outdoor collection. Burrow's outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry stain-resistant foam cushions. As always, you get free shipping on every order. Get 15% off at burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Welcome to the Intercooler Podcast. Hi everybody, welcome back to the Intercooler Podcast with Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel, episode 201. Andrew, yeah. A sort of magazine style show this week, because yes, there's an awful lot that we want to catch up on. It's been a busy start to the year, but particularly over the last couple of weeks, there's just so much going on that I really want to cover a lot of ground with this episode. Cool. We have just had the first round of the 2024 Formula One season, Bahrain Grand Prix. The idea was to discuss the Grand Prix and talk about...
We'd commissioned a story, didn't we? Which was going to go up on the TI website, and we canned it because it was so boring.
It was such a dull... Honestly, it felt like the 23rd Grand Prix of the 2023 season. It seemed like nothing had changed.
Nothing has changed.
Which was properly deflating after all winter. After a boring season, all winter, you think this one's going to be better.
Yeah, and testing said one thing, but then we went through all those, you know, first practice and second practice when Lewis was quicker, and we thought, oh, blimey, and you know, the Red Bulls, and then suddenly, actually, and the most demoralising thing was, you know, it wasn't the fact that he was pulling away at whatever it was, half a second lap or more. It's just when he put on that spare set of sauce, which he didn't even need in qualifying. And then went like a second and a half quicker than anybody else. Mm. And yeah, there's that old adage, isn't there, that, you know, if you're smart, you win a race at the slowest speed you can. And he just gave us a glimpse of what he and that car can do. Yeah, I don't think we're going to be talking much about Formula One this year. I hope I'm wrong. I really do hope that there's something about that circuit and that other people will get their shit together. I mean, that, you know, I think there are, although I'm probably just grasping at straws here, but clearly Red Bull would have started on their 2024 car before anybody else, because they would have known from the first race that they had the championship in the bag. And so maybe others, their pace of development will be greater. Mercedes-Benz have an all-new car. So clearly you can develop a new car quicker than you can develop a project that you've already been working on for 2 years. So you'd hope them to come on a bit. Ferrari showed signs of some promise. So, I mean, clearly, Max Verstappen is going to be the world champion. Mm. And I think what you should do, if you want to enjoy Formula One this year, just pretend Max doesn't exist. Okay, and pretend he's in one race and everybody else, and then I think it'll be really interesting. Because I think the battle between the Mercedes and the Ferraris, and the Astons and the McLarens, is going to be an interesting battle. Mm. And all you have to do to make Formula One fun again is just forget one car.
It's such a pity, though, isn't it, that we have to trick ourselves like this?
Yeah, absolutely.
To try and enjoy this thing.
Yeah.
But I think it's worth talking a little bit about the pickle that Formula One has got itself into.
How to get out of it.
Because the point of these new ground effect regulations introduced at the start of 2022 was to promote racing.
Yeah.
So allow the cars to follow one another closely.
Yeah.
So that we got better racing.
Yeah.
And I think there probably are some statistics that show overtakes are up 40% or something.
Yeah, and the idea was that you develop your downforce under the car rather than over it, so you don't get this filthy air spilling off the rear wing, and therefore cars are able to follow other cars more closely through corners, and then for they're close when they come onto straights, and then with a bit of DRS you can get past. That's the theory.
That is the theory. And perhaps it's been achieved to some degree or another. But what it hasn't done is made Formula One more exciting to watch.
No, not at all. And, you know, I guess what you don't know is what it would be, how even more boring than it is it might be had they not made the rule change. And if cars couldn't follow. Actually, I'm not sure it is.
But 2021 was so exciting.
2021 was so exciting. Yeah, you're absolutely right. But is that because of the rules, or is that just because you had two very closely matched cars?
Well, this is the point that I wanted to make. So it's admirable that they worked so hard to promote closer racing with a new set of aero regulations. I get that. It was an important thing to do. But all of this has made me realise that that is secondary to one other key point, which is that one way or another, the regulations have to be conceived in such a way that make it far more likely that you've got at least two teams at the front with almost equal machinery. That, for me, for the next set of regulations coming in 2026, for every other set of regulations that comes down the line, somehow finding a way to ensure that we have more than just one, you know, that we have two teams, four cars, competing on at least a level playing field, so that we do not necessarily know who's going to win the race, so that we do not necessarily know who's going to win the championship. It is, for me, the single most important consideration.
But the problem is, and this literally dates back to the dawn of Formula One, where in 1950, Alfa Romeo won every single race.
Yeah.
This problem is as old
as F1.
As F1.
Motor racing, yeah.
And, you know, and we can remember, well, you probably can't because you were two, but I can remember 1988, when McLaren won 15 out of 16 races. And if there'd been a 23 race season as it was last year, they would have won 22 out of 23. They would have done exactly what Red Bull did last year. And in all those, whatever it is, 74 years, the problem has never, no one has found a solution. So, I mean, how radical are we prepared to be? I mean, is that terrible acronym, BOP?
Yeah.
Should that be heading in the direct? That's, I can't see any other way of doing it other than, and I hate the balance of performance. I hate some of the iniquity it causes, particularly in sports car racing. And I've talked about this on the podcast many times before. But there comes a stage, doesn't there, when you're not dealing with what's a good thing to do. You're dealing with least worst options.
Yeah.
You know, the lesser of the two evils. And I hate the idea that just because one team does a better job than anybody else, and that's what we're looking at here now. You know, this is no criticism of Red Bull or Max Verstappen or anybody else. They're just doing their job better than anybody else. So you take that genius, brilliant success, whatever you want to call it, and think, well, okay, you've done really well, so we're going to penalise you now. And I hate that. But
yeah.
At the same time, how else is the sport going to survive?
How? And it's got to the point where it's not worth 2 hours of my Sunday.
No, and if it's not worth 2 hours of your Sunday, and you are as dyed-in-the-wool petrol racing fan as I know, then God, imagine you are you're Netflix now, and you're just starting to gather the raw material for whatever is the seventh season of Drive to Survive. I mean, you're going to be doing your nut, aren't you?
Yeah, you are. But also, if you're Formula One, because I think there is some data to show that the US audience switched off a bit last year.
They did. You hear stories, don't you, about, you know, half-price ticket sales at some of the latter races in the US and that sort of thing, yeah?
And it seems that we've got another year of it, at least another year, maybe two more years. And if you're Formula One, you're surely thinking, goodness me, this is going to cause some damage. And I think back, you mentioned Drive to Survive.
Yeah.
And there's a NASCAR equivalent. I think it's called Full Speed.
Yeah.
It's on Netflix. It's a good watch, actually. And I've never watched a NASCAR race in my life.
Yeah.
Which I need to put that right, actually, particularly having watched this documentary. But it just... So we know the US audience is enormously important to Formula One. And the US has its own homegrown racing series, Indy, NASCAR. And particularly NASCAR, and I realise this now, having watched this Netflix documentary. The racing,
and it's massively popular, isn't it?
It's massively popular. They might only be going left, right, on these ovals. But they are racing, and they are so close for hours and hours.
Yep.
And they're not nose to tail. They're side by side across the finish line.
At 200 miles an hour.
After hundreds of miles of racing.
But that's because they're all in the same car.
Yeah.
Essentially.
Yeah.
You know, you have a formula where, you know, you have silhouette bodywork on a Somebody's going to come on and scream at me and tell me that you know nothing about NASCAR and you're talking rubbish. But my understanding is that you have a spec chassis and a spec engine and you put silhouette bodywork on it, depending on whether you support Ford or GM or Toyota or whoever. And then you put the best person in it you can and off you go.
Mm. Mm.
We don't want Formula One to be that, though, do we?
We don't. But I'm thinking about the US audience, right? Yeah. This form of motorsport has come across their radar, Formula One. Everyone tells them it's the pinnacle of racing.
Yeah.
They switch it on. They watch the Bahrain Grand Prix. They're used to watching cars side by side across the finish line.
And what must they be thinking?
They must think, this is nonsense, surely.
Something has to be done. Everybody out there, let us know what you think. How do you, without unfairly penalising success, how do you take Formula One and make it more interesting? I mean, yeah, I'd look at anything. I'd look at reverse grids.
Yeah.
Just flip a coin. And it, whatever you do, some people say you can't do that because it's completely artificial, but Formula One's completely artificial. DRS is completely artificial. There's so much about Formula One which is already artificial. So, you know, that bird has flown. So what I think, you know, occasionally just completely random, get a computer to randomly draw. And so everybody goes through qualifying and Max is on pole again. And then suddenly the computer goes, excuse me, actually, Max, you're 20th.
Mm.
He'd still win the bloody race, though, wouldn't he?
He might well do.
But it might make it a bit more interesting. And and there would certainly be a lot more jeopardy because he'd be starting at the back. He'd have to work his way through. He could get taken out. And you wouldn't do it every race. You'd do it, maybe you say, like, sort of maybe four races a season or between 3 and 6 races. And you wouldn't say what the number is. So the teams couldn't second guess it.
Mm.
And it's a bit of a pantomime, but it's got to be better than falling asleep, hasn't it?
I agree. Clearly, the ideal here is that the teams competing at the front of the grid are on a sort of level footing, and it naturally happens that way, and the cars can follow and overtake each other. But it hasn't worked out that way. They've been fiddling with the regulations for years, and it hasn't worked out that way.
And the rule book gets thicker and thicker and thicker, the idea being that eventually you prescribe everything that could possibly make a big difference out of the rule book. But even so, even now, Red Bull just have something.
Mm.
They have this ability. And it's not just, you know, I don't think they've got a more powerful engine, but they have this aerodynamic efficiency, which, you know, allows the car to go quicker over a lap. But better than that, it has the most extraordinary ability to make the most out of DRS. And it does all of that without killing its tyres.
Mm. It's extraordinary, isn't it?
It is.
The way that car works.
The way, because if it just did one thing better than anything else, if you just thought, okay, fine, well, it's just unbelievable in slow corners. Well, the other teams could think, well, okay, well, maybe we'll be unbelievable in something else. But it is so much better everywhere, or almost everywhere. I think the only places that it struggles a bit is on really bumpy circuits, isn't it? Was it Singapore last year they didn't win?
Yeah.
And that was a real outlier circuit for them. Other than that, they're gone.
Mm. It's not promising for the rest of this season. Maybe the others will get their act together.
But or plough up all the tracks.
Yes.
Make them like Indian cricket wickets.
Something.
Yeah.
Something, please. I just want to mention quickly Lewis Hamilton to Ferrari, because we haven't had a chance to talk about that.
Have we not?
No.
Okay.
The biggest news story from F1 this year so far.
Yeah.
Did you see it coming? How surprised were you? Actually, we were standing in a car park when
we were on a job. We were doing a shoot, weren't we?
Yeah.
I was completely surprised. Completely surprised. I mean, okay, he has talked about it before and he has said, everybody wants to race a Ferrari and wouldn't it be nice? But he's also said, you know, I see myself seeing out my career at Mercedes-Benz.
Yeah, he said both, hasn't he?
Yeah. So I do wonder how Toto and the rest of the team are going to have taken this news, because one of the other things that was absolutely agreed, and I think it's actually even on Drive to Survive, is that whatever either Lewis or Mercedes did, it would be done with full knowledge of the other.
Yeah.
No one would ever drop a bomb on anyone. Mm. And Lewis appeared to have dropped a bomb.
He's done that. The curious thing is, and this has been overlooked in all the discussions around it so far, I think. So Mercedes and Lewis signed a new contract in August 2023.
Yeah.
For the 24 and 25 seasons.
Yeah. But with an 25 being an option.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But nothing for 26. They wouldn't give him a contract for 2026.
Succession planning.
Because they had this extraordinary 17-year-old Italian driver, Andrea Kimi Antonelli, who is said to be the next Lewis, the next Max.
Yeah.
And they didn't want to risk losing him by offering Lewis a 3-year contract. Mm. So as far as Lewis was concerned, there was no guarantee he was going to have a Mercedes seat for 2026. And everyone's looking at 2026 as an opportunity to win a title.
Yeah, because everybody has already decided that while the rules are the rules,
yeah,
which is last year, this year, and next, kind of, you know, it's already gone, hasn't it? The horse has bolted.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So from Lewis's point of view, he couldn't assume he was going to be in a Mercedes for 2026.
Maybe Lewis assumed that he wasn't going to be in a Mercedes for 2026.
And then Ferrari come along.
And then it's much more understandable.
Ferrari come along.
Yeah.
Here's a contract that takes us through 2026.
Yeah.
And we're a works team and we build our own powertrains, which is what you need, really.
Yeah.
It's a no-brainer.
And maybe Ferrari have shown him some things and said, look, you know, between you and me, we've got this. And he's thinking, well, that's all rather interesting. Mm. Well, it is and it isn't. You know, I think it's really brave.
Yeah.
And maybe he felt he didn't have a choice. Well, I suppose the choice would be to leave Formula One. But he's not going to end up in a Red Bull.
No.
That's clearly not going to happen. And, you know, I mean, Aston Martin and Ferrari are great teams and they're clearly going places. And I hope, but if you want to win a world championship, and let's not, you know, forget what is going on here, which has got, you know, I'm sure Ferrari are paying him an absolute fortune, but it's all about that eighth title, isn't it?
Yeah.
And where Lewis thinks he is most likely to find it. And it is Ferrari, but, you know, there's the age thing. Okay, you know, Alonso is doing fantastically well, whatever it is, 42, 43. Mm. But, you know, Lewis will be 40 before he does his before he drives a Ferrari in anger for the first time. That's one thing. Secondly, look at his teammate.
Yeah.
Right now, I haven't asked you this question. And okay, I would back Lewis to be better over race. But over one lap on identical cars, Lewis or Charles today?
Charles. I think Charles the fastest qualifier in F1.
I think Charles is the fastest driver in F1.
Mm.
And Charles is only going to go on getting better. And Lewis, and this is nothing against Lewis, it's just biology.
It's human nature.
Is at best going to stay the same or get worse.
Mm.
And then there's the Ferrari factor.
Mm.
And Ferrari is just not like any other team. And the fact is that, you know, that Charles is so integrated into that team.
Yeah.
He speaks the language fluently, and you cannot underestimate how important that is. And Lewis is going to go there, and nobody, not even Lewis Hamilton, not even the greatest driver there has been, which statistically he certainly is, and might well be actually, is bigger than Ferrari.
Mm.
So is he going to go in there and say, well, it needs to be this way? Because Ferrari will go, well, we're not doing it that way.
The flip side is that he's got the backing of John Elkann.
Yeah.
I think he's a personal friend. Which could be a big deal.
It could be.
But either way, it is tantalising, isn't it? It is delicious. The most successful and the biggest star in Formula One, and the most successful and the biggest team in Formula One coming together.
Who is going to score more points at Ferrari in the 2025 season? Charles Leclerc or Lewis Hamilton?
Should we make our guesses now? I think it's Leclerc. You know, I'm a huge Lewis fan. He's my favourite driver.
I absolutely think it's Leclerc.
But to walk into Charles' team and outscore him? Don't know. But the reason we talk about it now is because it was only in the last week or so that Toto Wolff admitted that they hadn't offered Lewis a 3-year contract because of this young lad, Antonelli, who we need to find out a bit more about him because he's clearly a superstar. But there's just one other parallel that I wanted to mention, and it highlights the importance of proper succession planning, which is what Wolff and Mercedes were doing here, keeping their options open further down the line. And that, it's a curious thing to say, but they weren't being over loyal to Lewis. That's the most successful driver team pairing ever. And yet they knew, they recognised that they had to keep their options open. They couldn't just give Lewis whatever he demanded, because if that cost them their relationship with Antonelli and he went elsewhere and he won championships at another team, they've blown it, haven't they, for years to come.
But it's still a gamble because, you know, do you remember Heikki Kovalainen?
Yes.
He was Antonelli. He was,
really,
as a youngster coming up through the Formula, he was just like the second coming. He was just unbelievable.
Wow.
Got into Formula One. Couldn't do it.
Won one Grand Prix, didn't he?
Look at Nick De Vries. Didn't Nick De Vries win everything?
I think so. Well, he won plenty on his way.
Won plenty.
Up. But it is extraordinary to me that people can look at a 17-year-old who's only raced up to F3 and say he's the next one.
Yeah. And maybe he is. But and some, you know, look at Lewis being the prime example, do exactly that. And they come in and they beat their double world championship winning teammate in their debut season. That's what Lewis did to Alonso in 2007.
Yeah.
And then others come along. And despite everything, despite all the evidence for your eyes that these guys, that this guy is going to just make everybody else look like, you know, also rounds, it doesn't happen.
Doesn't happen. But sometimes it's, anyway, back to this point about succession planning. So it was in 2011, Citroën, World Rally Championship, the two Sebastians, Loeb and Ogier. Loeb, the incumbent, then a 7 or 8 time world champion, superstar. And Ogier came in the same team and gave Loeb a really hard time.
Yeah.
Ogier won 5 rounds of the championship that year. He only finished 3rd in the end, but he was neck and neck with Loeb for a long time. And the two fell out. And Citroën was loyal, and it held on to Sebastian Loeb. It seems like the right thing to do. Huge amount of success together. It would be extraordinary to let Loeb go at that point.
Yeah. But what you're saying is they should have done.
But in hindsight, Loeb competed for one more year with Citroën, won the championship again, then he retired. Meanwhile, Ogier's been snapped up by Volkswagen. And the moment Loeb retired, Ogier won the next 6, I think. And Citroën let him go.
As you said to me before we came on air, they sacked the wrong Seb.
They sacked the wrong Seb. Ah, it's a brutal thing to... It's a brutal position to take, but...
Can you imagine you're the person who sacked Sebastian Loeb?
Yeah. But the outcome here was that Citroën couldn't sign a top draw driver. It couldn't sign a championship standard driver.
Yeah.
And so it pulled out of the sport.
Mm.
And had it held on to Ogier instead of Loeb, maybe it would have continued winning championships.
A lesson learned.
Succession planning, it's enormously important.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
let's move it on then. And we're doing what goes up here, which we haven't done for a little while, but it's our sort of semi-regular segment where we look at the market, see what's going on, particularly with used cars, see what values are looking like, see what's hot, what's not. And things are all a little bit flat at the moment. I mean, what are your insights into what's going on in the market at the moment?
You're asking the wrong person, I think, but what am I? Yeah, I think things have been flat, or in lots of cases, if you look at it over the last couple of years, a lot of the heat has come out of the market. I think prices have been coming down. I think good stuff, really good stuff, is still desirable.
Yeah.
I think it always remains that way. And maybe now is a good time to be getting in, I don't know. But the sort of heady days, particularly with, brand new cars, which people could just flip and expect to make money. And so your position, the very fact that you had an order form, had a monetary value all to itself. Certain cars, yes, still, but certain other cars, particularly those which aren't very special limited edition cars, it's certainly not what it was.
So, one of the ways of sort of taking a read, taking the temperature of the market, is to look at auction results.
Mm.
Because this is why online auctions are fantastic, because they cut through the noise. And how often do we see cars in classifieds listed at fanciful prices? That doesn't determine the price of the car,
No.
that number that you see there. The auction result does. And we, as hopefully you all know, we are now partnered with Pistonheads, which has got its new auction platform. And there are a few results that I just want to talk to you about here. The first is a 1998 Lotus Elise S1.
Oh, yeah. Nice car.
Gorgeous car.
Yeah, yeah.
And actually, last year, Pistonheads crowned... It was 25 years of Pistonheads last year. And so they did this big thing celebrating the most significant cars of that era, that time, 25 years. And they crowned the S1 Elise the best performance car from that period.
Yeah, I can believe
since it. Since 1998.
Yeah.
And that is a gorgeous car, the S1 Elise. And actually, I've not driven a standard one. This was a standard one, 118 horsepower, which is so lovely. Quaint, isn't it, as lovely. A power output.
Oh, honestly, you drive it, you know, it doesn't feel like it, because those very early Elises, okay, this is probably post... aluminium brakes, but it'll still be a really, really light car.
Yeah.
800 kilo car, something like
that. Yeah.
And 118 horsepower goes a long way in a car like that.
Mm, it really does.
Yeah.
And I bet it steers beautifully. That's I bet so the suspension stunning. Is lovely and simple.
I went up to Hethel when they were making the last of the Elises, and I drove, they have an immaculate low mileage S1.
Yeah.
And it was wet, and I had that, and the last one, I preferred the S1.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Gosh.
Just as a thing to sort of, I mean, as an ownership proposition, I mean, the more one, it was massively more well equipped and it would have been you know, easier to live with it.
But to have in the shed at home.
But just to go and skid around a wet track,
mm.
Yeah, the S1 was just more fun.
God, I think they're gorgeous things. This one had 62,000 miles, sold for just over 14,000, 14,250. I think that's a lot of car, and it's not going to shed money from that point, is it?
And also, I mean, so much, particularly with cars like that, and we must always say this with all old cars, but particularly with cars that are, you know, quite low volume, you know, a little bit old, not made by manufacturers that make bazillions of cars. The history is so important. But if that's a nice car that's got a known history, the 62,000 miles is, you know, is fine. Those K-series engines, if properly looked after, are pretty good. That's a lot of, I mean, yeah.
Gorgeous car.
Yeah.
So a couple more that I want to talk about. There was a 2010 Subaru Impreza SGI Cosworth CS400. Do you remember that one? When Subaru did a very limited edition car with Cosworth. And of course, you assume they do that sort of thing with ProDrive, don't you? The history of those two organisations.
I'm presuming from the name, this was a 400 horsepower car.
Yeah, 395 bhp. Yeah,
yeah, 400 PS. Yeah,
It's the hatchback one, one of just 75 such cars. So it is a properly rare car. I bet it's rapid as well. Sold for 27,750, which, do you know? I wouldn't have guessed that they'd be worth that kind of money, but I guess. With only 75 built, and there's still a huge following.
I think that's what you're paying for, isn't it?
Yeah.
You're paying for the exclusivity. It's the not, rarity. If I'm completely honest, a kind of car that I would spend that amount of money on. But I haven't driven one, so what do I know?
Sure. But there are plenty of people out there who love that sort of thing, aren't there?
Yeah.
And this applies to the next car I want to talk about as well. But it's a good example of a car that works at auction, because who knows what something like that's worth? 75 of them out there. Where do you begin to... you know, assign a value to that without sticking it on an auction platform and seeing what someone's willing to pay, which is all a car's ever
worth. It is the ultimate arbiter, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And particularly for the last one that I'll mention. Do you remember the Tommy Kyra?
The Tommy Kyra ZZ?
ZZ.
Yes. Oh, my goodness.
Pistonheads had one, a 99 car, a race car, actually, on the auction platform. Sold for $17,750.
I mean, you could tell me that sold for $7,000 or $70,000.
That's right.
And I wouldn't know whether it was cheap or expensive.
Yeah, you just wouldn't know, would you?
No.
Actually, there will be a road car on the Pistonheads auction platform soon, a Tommy Kyra road car, which is a cool thing to look out for.
I never drove one. I couldn't tell you a thing about it.
Do you know, I didn't really know anything about them either until I started reading it up on them. But only about 200 ever made. But we probably all did drive them on Gran Turismo 2.
Speak for yourself. I'm too old even for that.
So it's an extraordinary looking thing. It's kind of a somewhere between a Radical and an Elise. It's a Japanese car.
Yeah, yeah.
With the 700 kilograms.
Yeah.
Super lightweight. Mm. With the naturally aspirated 2-litre Nissan SR20 DE, which is one of those engines that they perhaps have a minor following. But when you start looking at the technical specs
Is that the twin cam Primera engine?
Yeah,
great engine.
So it's a proper great buzzy engine. 180 horsepower.
Very strong as well.
Super strong.
Yeah.
David Tuig will be listening to this, nodding along, because he'll know everything about those engines.
Yeah.
So that is a very, very interesting car. And as I said, there is a road car coming along soon. So we'll have to keep an eye out and see what those things are worth. Now, remember, if you're looking to buy or you're just browsing, visit pistonheads.com/buy/auctions or click the link in the description to see what's on the platform right now and what's sold recently. And if you're thinking of selling your car on Pistonheads auction platform, visit pistonheads.com/sell/auctions or click the link in the description. And please remember to tell them that the intercooler sent you.
Yes, that's very important.
That's very important. I just want to reflect briefly, Andrew, on last week's podcast.
Oh, yes. Mr. May.
Mr. James May.
Yeah.
A big, big deal for me. I had a great time. I'd never met him before, so it's fantastic to spend a bit of time with him. He's an old friend of yours. But it's gone down well, that episode. People have been talking about it a lot.
Yeah.
The video has had close to 300,000 views in a week.
As we record this, yeah.
Which is, for a 90-minute video with two camera angles,
yeah,
I think that's extraordinary that it's done that. Yeah. So if you haven't listened to that episode yet, it's available on all the usual podcast platforms, or you can watch the full thing on YouTube. But he's kind of a breath of fresh air, is James, actually. And I think what I most appreciate about him is that he's got a very broad perspective on the car world. So he's got a couple of supercars at home, but he's also tried the hydrogen thing.
Yeah, he's owned two hydrogen cars.
And electric cars as well, and small cars, powerful cars, everything. So he's just interesting to listen to, isn't he?
I think because it's a bit difficult, because I'm not name dropping. James and I just happened to start an auto car almost the same time. So I've known him for almost 35 years.
Mm.
So when we talk, it's like you're talking to somebody that you've known for 35 years, and we've been good friends. But what people who listen to it, who I've spoken to, have said is that he seems to be completely himself and complete, and that's how it came. To me, I kind of forgot that we were recording a podcast. I was just having a chat with a mate. That really is, that is him, that is James. And I think that there is a sort of, I'm proud that he felt, sufficiently relaxed and enjoyed himself to talk as freely and openly as he did about such a wide range of things. Everything from his early life to, to the Grand Tour. And I think hopefully it just came across as being a good chat between like-minded, for want of a better word, petrol heads.
Mm. Yeah, I'm sure it did. People were very kind about it, and I appreciate all the feedback, everyone. Thank you ever so much. If you haven't listened, you really must. But we're going to do more, aren't we? We're going to get guests on more often.
Yeah, we just recorded one.
We did. We've just recorded one that I won't give away just yet. But next week we've got Tiff Nidell coming on.
Tiff, he's always such good value.
Always such good value. So that'll be really good fun.
Yeah.
So let us know if there are some guests that we absolutely have to get on. Get in touch. And while you're doing it, if you're doing it on Twitter or on Instagram or something, tag them as well. That helps, actually. Mm-hmm. That does help to make these things happen. We can't escape the unusual engine configurations chat.
Yeah. This was like one of those podcasts I did where you and I realised we kind of got a podcast recording. We haven't got an idea on our head. I think you came up with it, didn't you?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, and you just go, unusual engine configurations. And I went, that sounds interesting. And I thought about, W12s and W16s, and I even came up with a W18.
Yeah.
But actually, just scratching the surface. And particularly if you go beyond the world of the car, which we can do on this podcast every so often.
Oh, yeah.
And we came up with all sorts of weird shit, didn't we?
Mm.
X24.
Mm.
And this triangular engine. Remember the triangular engine, which was... Yeah,
unbelievable.
I mean, with three crankshafts, and it was just, it went down really well, didn't it?
It did, but people keep getting in touch saying, you didn't mention this one, and then, of course, we have to go and talk about it, because it is that fascinating. But I bring it up now, because last week, Bugatti announced that it's ditching the W16 for its next hypercar in favour of a V16.
V16.
Oh, that's cool, isn't it? In this, well, you just assume that something. I know it's been done before, but
I don't know whether it's going to be cool or not. I mean, yeah, I mean, Auto Union had a V16 race car in the 1930s. Yeah. You know, Cadillac had a V16 road car in the 1930s. BRM had a spectacularly unsuccessful V16 race car in the early 1950s. It's been done before. I don't know whether, you know, bigger is better and, you know, more is more rather than more being less being more. People tend to think, I don't know. We'll have to wait and see. But it's a V16, isn't it, with a big hybrid component on it.
Big hybrid component. So, and they also released a very short video showing with some engine sound.
Yeah.
I don't think it's got any turbos on it.
Wow.
Hence the hybrid component, maybe.
So it sounds, presumably, then it could sound amazing.
Yeah.
I have had a conversation with someone, and let's just say this is a person who kind of knows, and he's a bit sceptical about it.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
A bit sceptical about Bugatti going over, because I mean, my understanding is I think it's going to develop at least as much power through the hybrid as it does through the ICE engine. We'll have to see, won't we? Hopefully we'll get to drive it one day.
I do wonder what the advantage is, because we know the packaging benefits of a W16. It's a much more compact engine. Placing two banks of 8 cylinders, it's not easy, that.
I suspect what has happened is, you know, is it a coincidence that this has happened at the same time that Bentley have canned their W12? And I suspect that within the Volkswagen group, there is either a directive that doesn't work anymore, or there are part suppliers who've been told not to supply, and there's just not enough. There'll be a reason. I just don't think it's a coincidence that both W engines have just disappeared at the same time. But I mean, a V16, if it is naturally aspirated, I don't know. I mean, if it's small and it's really revvy,
yeah,
that could sound unbelievable.
Wow, it could be interesting. But I just think it's fantastic that even in 2024, the age of the totally out there combustion engine isn't yet done.
Not yet.
At least not if you're buying a Bugatti.
Last chance saloon, guys. Believe me.
Yeah, go and get yourself a Bugatti.
Yeah.
Andrew, you've been climbing a rather large hill.
Yes. Are we allowed to talk about this on there? I suppose we are. I'll be brief. I wandered up Kilimanjaro.
Wow.
Yeah. I did. Well, there's a big story on the website and the app. And if you want to hear about the adventures of an elderly man with dodgy knees trying to climb a mountain, which turned out to be far too high, then it's all on there and you can go and read it. And I think I say in the story that if I'd known what I was going to do, I'd never have done it.
Yeah.
Which is not to say that I regret doing it, but it was just because it's, because quite a few people do it, and because in Everest terms, it's not that high. It's 19,300 and something feet, which means it's not quite 6,000 metres, whereas Everest is 8,000 metres.
Yeah, but I think...
29,000
feet. But I think that demonstrates how tall it is. It's two-thirds of the way up to...
Well, maybe that is another way of looking at it. And I think what I underestimated, what I didn't really focus on, was that people who go and climb Everest tend to spend a very long time acclimatising. So that their systems are, teeming with red blood cells, and that makes all the difference. And we took one of the longest routes you can take to get up Kilimanjaro, but still nothing like enough time to acclimatise properly to the altitude. I actually really, really enjoyed the first 5 days, where you're just basically just hiking to ever higher, higher, higher. But then the last bit, where you have to get from a camp to the summit and back to below that camp in a day. So just as a little idea, it's 2.5 miles, I think, from the camp to the summit, and it takes 7 hours to walk it.
Yeah.
By the time you're at the top, every single thing is difficult. Some really basic things are so difficult you can't do them. I had a slightly loose bootlace. I couldn't bend down to retie. I literally just didn't have the energy to tie a shoelace. And that's not me exaggerating for effect. That is absolutely and literally the case.
It's altitude, isn't it?
It's altitude. I was very lucky. I didn't get sick at all. I didn't have any of the nausea or stomach cramps or diarrhea or any of the stuff, the traditional hallmarks of altitude sickness. I just couldn't breathe.
Mm, God.
And, you know, by the time you get that, you've been on the road, you've been on your feet for the best part of a week. And yeah, it was so much harder than I thought it was going to be. Far and away the hardest thing that I've done. And I'm really pleased to have done it.
Mm.
But actually getting to the summit, other than the sort of, I guess, the pride of standing there and thinking, bloody hell, you know, at the age of 58, I have somehow managed to drag myself to the top of this thing. There wasn't much to be enjoyed about that. And it was only a day and a half later when, you know, you descend however many thousands and thousands and thousands of feet it is in a day and a half, by which stage your knees are pretty comprehensively ruined. But you get out the final gate, turn right, and there's a bar. And you sit there with your mates, yeah, as I did, and you think, well, I'm just going to have one, because you're heading off to lunch and you'll think, well, I'll have a few beers then. But one turns into two, into three, into four, and whatever. With all your friends. And you begin, only then do you begin to sort of get your head around, because it's over. Only then can you really mentally afford to think about what you've done, because up until that moment, you've still got stuff to do. And when you've no longer got anything to do other than drink beer and get on a bus, then that is wonderful. That is utterly wonderful, because you're there with your people who you didn't know a week ago, who now feel like close friends, sharing this mutually extraordinary adventure. And all the danger and all the effort and the pain and the exhaustion is kind of gone. And actually, of all the things I'll probably remember most and most fondly about climbing to 19,341 feet is being back at the bottom, not having to do it anymore.
Yeah. I can well imagine. But the sense of achievement must be enormous. So Kilimanjaro, is one of the tallest mountains that you can walk up, isn't it? Is that fair?
Yeah, it absolutely is. That's why we did it. It is, you know, because, you know, I'm not the sort of person that, you know, is going to get on well with crampons and ice axes and ropes and that sort of. You literally do. I mean, there's a bit of scrambling, a bit of clambering, but yeah, basically you walk up it. Mm. So you don't need any technical climbing skills. You don't need, you know, to have lessons. And yeah, so so that kind of makes it sound easy, doesn't it? It's just putting one foot in front of the other.
Yeah.
You try it.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, there are, yeah.
And not everyone makes it.
No. Well, again, it so much depends on a lot of, you know, it depends on who you go with. And obviously you have to be guided. And we have this company called Ultimate Kilimanjaro, who were absolutely extraordinary. They looked after us, I mean, so well. I don't think I'd have got up there with a less good team. But also, you know, you've got to be careful about the route. There are some routes which will get you up and down in 4 days, but there's a less than 25% success rate.
Oh, wow.
We took 8 days, and the success rate on an eight-day route is about 80 to 85%, which is actually what we, you know, we had 13 of us, and one didn't make it. But, you know, two others had to be talked out of turning around. Another one was quite distressed on the summit, and another one came off the mountain on a stretcher. So it's not, you know, and ultimately we're all completely fine. Mm. And only one of the 13 didn't get to the summit. So, you know, that kind of works, you know, backs up the stats. But, yeah, it's not guaranteed. I was lucky, I didn't get sick. And even if you are lucky and you don't get sick and you're quite well trained, it's hard.
Yeah.
It's really, really bloody hard.
It does sound it.
Yeah.
Goodness me, well, congratulations.
Thank you.
A fantastic thing to have done. And we get to hear about it without putting in all the work. So thank you. Okay, we'll wrap that one up there.
Okay.
But thank you, everybody, for watching or for listening. Just make sure to hit the little follow button or the subscribe button. It means you don't miss an episode. It helps us enormously as well, though. So please do that. And make sure you come back next week.
Bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc. Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.